Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Katherine Johnson. Katherine is a science writer and the author of the Indie Book Award longlisted The Better Son and Pescador's Wake. Her latest novel, Matryoshka, tells of family, loss, and seeking refuge. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I speak with an Australian writer, and together we explore their books, writing, their literary culture, and it all comes out on Final Draft in the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Now, the Great Conversations podcast is a way to enlarge the discussion and get behind the scenes of the book and explore the way it addresses pressing issues in our world. And a big thank you if you have been enjoying the Great Conversations podcast, and especially if you've shared it with friends. I love that people are subscribing and rating, and it is a great way to get the word out about Australian writing. So hit subscribe, give us a rating, or just physically tell a friend about the Great Conversations podcast, especially if they're a reader. Maybe tell them in a bookstore. And look, if you do subscribe, it means you get a new episode every week. So I love producing these, and thank you for listening. In Matryoshka, Sarah Basova has returned to her family home at the foot of Mount Wellington following the death of her grandmother, Nina. Nina Basova raised Sarah as her own following the teenage pregnancy of Sarah's mother, Helena. Now, a chance meeting with Abdul, an Afghan refugee, sees Sarah re-evaluating her ties to family as she seeks to forgive her mother and finally discover the identity of her father. This is Final Draft. You're on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and it's my great pleasure to share a book that I've really enjoyed. Katherine Johnson is an author and science writer. Her books include the Indie Book Award longlisted The Better Son and Pescador's Wake. Her latest novel, Matryoshka, is a story of family, loss, and secrets. Sarah Basova has returned to her family home at the foot of Mount Wellington following the death of her grandmother. Nina Basova raised Sarah as her own following the teenage pregnancy of Sarah's mother, Helena. A chance meeting with Abdul, an Afghani refugee, has Sarah re-evaluating her ties to family, and she seeks to forgive her mother and finally discover the identity of her father. Now, Katherine is joining me on the line from Tasmania. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Andrew, and thank you for that introduction. That's a very good summation of the book. Thank you.
There is so much happening in this book. I wrote a few different ideas around what I wanted people to know, but it struck me as I was thinking about Matryoshka, family is at the heart. But it's a concept that has so many iterations. So Sarah is watching her own family sort of dissolve following the departure of her husband. He's left her. They're living in Queensland. But she's never really had this nuclear vision of family. She was raised by her grandmother, but she thought of her as her mother till about the age 12. And then there's this contrast where we have Abdul, who's somehow able to endure the painful separation of oceans and war and violence, to still have this relationship with his family in Afghanistan. Then the main vision of this sort of suburban middle-class family is the really strained relationship of Sarah's boss, Dale, and her friend, Claire. If we can take your analogy of the Matryoshka, and I feel like this is going to happen a bit, do you think we as a society, do we ignore the layers of family connection for this sort of particularly shallow veneer of normalcy?
Well, that's a good question. So Matryoshka, I probably should explain too, Matryoshka is the Russian word for the Russian doll, so all the layers of particularly the maternal line that are around us and then the next generations that follow. And family is really central to the book, and particularly the feeling of belonging and identity and the fear of abandonment, really. Sarah felt that she was abandoned by her own mother, Helena, when she was young and raised by her grandmother, Nina, and never understood why her mother abandoned her. So she's fiercely protective of her own daughter, Ellie, and doesn't want her to experience the same feelings. So that sense of protection and layers of family are very important to her. So when her grandmother, Nina, dies, she feels quite at sea, because she was her rock and her connection to her history, really. But she does have a very estranged relationship with her own mother. And so meeting Abdul, who has who's forcibly separated from his family, and seeing what he is enduring and seeing how much he would love to be with his family really makes Sarah stop and pause and think she's actually missing out on other connections, other layers in her family that perhaps she should try and pursue and make peace with. So yes, there's all sorts of layers of belonging and history that come into the story. And as you say, there's the story of her boss in Tasmania. Sarah's a geneticist, and she has a boss in Tasmania who doesn't, I think, appreciate the family that he has and doesn't treat them as respectfully as he might. So there are contrasts in the book that set different families off against each other and make Sarah really think about what's important to her.
And I don't mean to pick on the relationship of Dale and Claire, but they really represent, I guess, an idea of family that we still see so dominant in the media, despite shifting visions of who we are as a society. This idea of a male breadwinner and then his wife, who had, and I particularly loved this because I'm a speech pathologist as well. Claire's a speech pathologist. But she's given up her career because Dale's sort of, I don't know, I guess what would we say? He's the power breadwinner sort of academic.
Mm.
And theirs is a very sort of veneer of happiness, but a strain underneath. And yet they are this dominant conception. And I like the way you sort of paralleled them.
Yes, I think it's a challenge still, isn't it, in society to try and manage career and family and have some sort of equity in how that's done, and the choices that people make can be judged either way if people choose to keep working full time or not. So there are those work life challenges that I think are really ever present for people still. So yes, I mean that's right. That's well spotted. But even in the day of, so Nina came out after World War II as a refugee after the Second World War, and her husband is working up in the hydro, and she's up there for some time, but ends up coming down to Hobart for her daughter's education, which is, she sees as very important for her own liberation and freedom. So I think the challenges are ongoing, certainly not just now, and the way people navigate their way through those challenges and maintain positive relationships with their partners it can be a unique story for every family, I think.
You had me thinking particularly of Annabelle Crabb's really fabulous book, The Wife Drought, and that conception of people needing that support system and then the different ways that it's shared. But you've mentioned there Nina's migration, and very much Nina's migration to Australia in that post-war period is juxtaposed with Abdul's and that of the Hazara community in that sort of becomes a part of Sarah's life. And the shared experiences of suspicion and of being ostracized, even abused by this dominant community, link the histories. So as a friendship between Sarah and Abdul develops, Sarah constantly finds herself second-guessing her efforts, the impact that her contribution might have in the face of this sort of intractable system. Did you find yourself hopeful as you were developing these stories?
I did. So I have a friend who's an Afghani asylum seeker who's been deemed a refugee, and it was a really chance encounter that I had with him. And then that story wove its way into Matryoshka with his permission, because it's a perfect story to follow Nina's story, that wave of immigration, of refugees after World War II, and then the current group of people who are coming also seeking refuge. So I met this man completely by chance. I was dropping my son off at a saxophone lesson, and as I was dropping him off, the door beside me opened and this man was coming out. And so there were townhouses side by side, and I'd recently seen the film Mary Meets Muhammad, which is about Hazara people in Hobart, and I recognise this man because his features are quite distinctive, or the Hazara features are quite distinctive, which is, of course, what puts people at risk in their own country. So we began a conversation, and he really revealed his life story there on the footpath with my daughter standing there and me listening. And then he invited us inside, and we had tea, and there were three other men inside who were also refugees, and it was an incredible situation, a very unexpected situation, where here we were in Tasmania being welcomed into a house of strangers who were seeking asylum here. And we began a friendship each week. As my son had his class, we would have tea, and we had stories, and we had some English lessons, and we just struck up a lovely friendship. And I was always ever hopeful that his story was going to end well here, and he was certainly his claims about, I think it's about five or six years later now, have been shown to be true. He is a refugee. But it's been a very torrid process for him, and seeing that firsthand really brought that home. And I think that experience is reflected in Sarah's meeting of Abdul. My story is fictionalised, but she encounters what it might be like for somebody entering the country on those terms, and thinks back for the first time what it must have been like for her grandmother when she came to Tasmania.
And so what parallels did you find in the intersection of your narrative of the immigrant experience and those of being a woman? So Nina in particular, she finds, and this is when she moves down from the hydro, particularly to Hobart, that she's not valued in the community because she's perceived as having little worth. She's not working on the scheme and is perhaps even a threat. The virtue of other women's husbands, I think, is mentioned at one point.
Yes, so she doesn't feel welcome, and she expects things to be as they might have been at home, and she expects people to offer her meals, or she expects for there to be some kind of welcome, which isn't forthcoming. And she's viewed with suspicion, and as a Russian person, also as a woman, and the closed-mindedness of people who I think really are operating out of fear rather than anything else, fear and ignorance. And it's that idea that until you have a personal experience and manage to have that human face, you sometimes are reacting out of fear and ignorance and don't even know it. So I think very often, as in that case of the film Mary Meets Muhammad, the documentary which shows how people, once they do meet others, that the idea of them being others is so reduced, and friendships form, and those barriers that may have been there disappear. But Nina's experience, and of course it wasn't the same for everybody who came, and she brought her own concerns with her as well. So perhaps she might have done more when she arrived than she did as well. The experiences can be quite different for different people, as they are in the book. There are other characters who had a different experience, but hers wasn't positive, and that experience of being not welcomed and feeling that there's fear around her being there, I think is what breeds secrets, and it breeds lies, and it can be destructive for children and grandchildren. And instead, where you could have a welcoming experience, and people become part of a community in a much healthier way, much more productive way, and become productive citizens, able to express themselves as they want to, and without having to feel so shut down.
Do you think there are elements of Nina's experience that were particular to her being a woman? She was a woman on her own. Her husband was working up on the hydro. And I also noted that Sarah very much experienced, so with her ex, he was always presumptive that she would be able to drop everything, that somehow her job was less important. And then when she gets a new job, she's queried as to whether her work is, her research proposal is her own, like somehow she can't have come up with it on herself. Is there something still of being a woman that you are ostracized and presumed upon in a way that a man in the same experience wouldn't be?
Oh, I think that's definitely the case, and I think that can be the case in fields like science. Hopefully not frequently, but it certainly can be, and that was the case for Sarah, where she was putting a proposal together that was very valid, but that she was being, well, because her boss happens to be the sort of personality that he is and quite old-fashioned, didn't necessarily believe that she was responsible for the proposal she had put forward. And Nina probably had fewer options when she arrived after the Second World War. She carved a way for herself to have her career, and she needed to have a career, so she would have boarders to the house who were sometimes people from her community, and she would she made dresses and was an amazing seamstress and made a wedding dress for the governor's daughter, and she found her way to be an independent woman, and she was determined to make sure that her daughter Helena, who was Sarah's mum, had a good education and had those choices. So Sarah becomes a doctor and a very a leading doctor in her field in heart surgery in Sydney. So there is that idea very evident in the book that women do have to sometimes fight for the right to have the careers that they want to have and have the independence that they want to have and not have it presumed that they can have an easier ride than their partners necessarily in terms of being able to just be very flexible. I think that needs to extend to both genders.
Now, you've mentioned secrets, and woven throughout all of the relationships is a mystery. And the thing that I found most brilliant about your storytelling is that it's a mystery that's actually no mystery at all, because each of the characters holds a piece of the puzzle that is Sarah's paternity. And it's actually their failure to open up, to communicate and to trust that sees it shrouded. And I wondered, what price do you feel we pay for secrets? And why do you think we make this choice? I'm particularly interested in the choice that Helena made to, I guess, not explore further. And there's obviously a lot of trauma behind this. And there are things that we won't reveal for those yet to read. But what price do we pay for secrets?
Yes, secrets keep appearing in my books. They appeared too in Pescador's Wake, my first book, and in The Better Son as well. And they seem to keep recurring in the stories that I write. And I think they are intriguing. And I think the reasons behind them, as you say, are really intriguing. What motivates people to keep secrets? And I think sometimes I start Matryoshka talking about the idea that we tell our children and our grandchildren the stories that we want them to remember. We tell them the stories about themselves that we want them to know. And I think there's a bit of that in why secrets are kept. We don't want to burden the next generation with stories of the past. And I think there is something to be said for that. And it's a very tricky decision, I think, whether everything is told or whether everything isn't told. But I think in hiding big secrets, the price of that is that the people who are having the secrets kept from them don't have a full understanding of the secret keeper, if you like. So they view this person and try to figure them out and can't really get to the bottom of why they are the way they are because they don't have the full picture. And I think people would be more forgiving of each other if they understood why they are the way they are. And so that, I think that probably is why in people learning the truth about someone, they sometimes can resolve situations in their relationships that arise when those secrets have been kept.
Mm. Let's close out our conversation with some of the wonderful characters you create. And I want to talk about the roles that each of the Basova women take on. And I don't want to make too much of this, but I do feel like they illuminate many of the events of your story. So we have Nina, and you've mentioned Nina was a seamstress, and it seems within the story and her role in the family, she seeks to cover herself in garbs and to protect, but also to hide. Then Helena, her daughter, becomes a doctor, and we learn that very much she strives, but also struggles to heal wounds within the family. Then we have Sarah. Sarah's a geneticist, and her quest very much becomes to unravel strands of the family story, much like the layers of the Matryoshka doll. I wanna challenge you, and you know, I'm sure you probably aren't writing a sequel, but what would you then say would be the role that you would paint for Sarah's daughter Ellie, thinking about this and the way their roles seem to mirror their relationships in the family?
You read the book so carefully and thoroughly, Andrew. I thank you for doing that, because it's a real compliment, and it's lovely to be able to talk to someone who's thought about it so carefully. I think Sarah's also concerned about what's passed on to the next generation, and in her role as a geneticist, she learns about epigenetics, which is the idea that we can inherit our parents' and grandparents' histories effectively. So the environmental change that happens, not to the genes themselves, but around the outside of genes, it seems can be passed from generation to generation, which can be a confronting idea, but I think in some ways maybe it's positive too, that if the environment is right, healing can happen. So I think for Ellie, who in a way, I guess if you extend the metaphor, is the smallest of the Matryoshka dolls, maybe she's the one that doesn't have a secret. Maybe she's the one that knows her history and is at peace somehow with her history. Mm-hmm. And the work that's gone before her in terms of healing, and is provided with an environment where she can properly assimilate her past and carry it with a bit more peace and a bit more knowledge and a bit more wisdom going forward, hopefully, without so much fear, and hopefully that would create openness in terms of perhaps not repeating some of the mistakes of the past that have plagued the women in her family, but will allow a more positive and optimistic future.
She can turn her eye outward, as it were, and perhaps the healing that she does will be broader. As much as Helena and Sarah particularly are doing work that reverberates out through the world, perhaps Ellie can take that to another level.
Yes, that's right. I think that's right. If people can heal themselves, they can look outward.
That's it for this great conversation with Catherine Johnson. Catherine's new novel, Matryoshka, is out now through Ventura Press. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. If you're enjoying Great Conversations from Final Draft, hit subscribe in iTunes or wherever you're listening to this podcast and receive a new episode delivered straight to your phone every week. Don't forget, you can share this podcast by giving it a rating, sharing it on Facebook, or just telling your friends, maybe pulling their phone out of their hands and just hitting subscribe for them so that they can get new books every week. To keep up with the latest books, writing and literary culture, you can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. The handle to look for is @FinalDraft2SER. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. See you then.